Across Australia, you're listening to Radio National.
Good morning, this is AM. I'm Brendan Trembarth. There's high anxiety in the South Korean capital, Seoul. The communist regime in the north has threatened all-out war if there are moves to punish Pyongyang for torpedoing a South Korean warship in March. Australia has praised South Korea's handling of an investigation into the sinking and the government's restraint. But Australia's Foreign Minister Stephen Smith is warning that military retaliation could have grave consequences for the entire region, as North Asia correspondent Mark Willacy reports.
South Korea is a nation largely unruffled from having to live next door to a boisterous, bad-tempered, nuclear-armed neighbour. But in shops, train stations and restaurants throughout the South, people stop to hear the findings of the international investigation into the sinking of the Cheonan. Now that the government has made it clear North Korea was behind the attack, I am worried, says 29-year-old Hwang Yeop-chan. This might lead to war, he says. I think we should deal with this without emotion, says 57-year-old Shin Dong-guk. We should cooperate with our allies and the international community to find a response, he says. And there are several ways South Korea could respond, but whenever it deals with Pyongyang, it has to tread carefully. Yoo Myung-hwan is South Korea's foreign minister. North Korea's military provocation not only destroys the peace and security of the international community, but it also contravenes the armistice agreement, says the minister. The government will take firm and strict measures, he says. But those firm and strict measures probably do not include military retaliation. After all, the 20 million residents of Greater Seoul are well within the range of the North's missiles. And with 1.2 million men under arms, Pyongyang boasts the world's fifth largest military. With the help of its US allies, the South would probably prevail in any war, but it would be a bloodbath. In Tokyo, Australia's Foreign Minister Stephen Smith praised South Korea's restraint, but warned Seoul against a military response.
That of itself would not be, in our view, in South Korea's interest or in North Asia's interest or in the interests of our region, the Asia Pacific.
No military retaliation, but South Korea is expected to put on a show of force, with Seoul and Washington likely to stage joint naval manoeuvres and anti-submarine drills in the Yellow Sea, right where the warship sank. Tough new sanctions against Pyongyang will also be sought, and South Korea is almost certain to pull the rug out from under efforts to restart the stalled six-party nuclear talks on North Korea, an inevitable outcome, according to the Foreign Minister, Stephen Smith.
In the face of this violation, I think it'll be some time before we can contemplate a resumption of those discussions.
North Korea was quick to respond to the international report in its usual strident tones. If punished, it will mean all-out war, says this newsreader on state television in Pyongyang. The findings of this investigation are a deliberate and bandit-like conspiracy, she says. As the world knows, there is one thing that is very predictable about North Korea, and that's its willingness to carry out a threat. This is Mark Willacy reporting for AM.
The German Chancellor has indicated she's still keen for a tax on global financial markets to help secure the system. Angela Merkel was the host of an international finance conference in Berlin. She made the point that the top developed nations had promised so much and delivered so little in response to the global financial crisis. Europe correspondent Emma Alberici.
At the height of the global financial crisis in 2008, when governments had ploughed trillions of dollars into propping up banks and other financial institutions, Angela Merkel recalled how the group of 20 most powerful nations agreed that every product, every actor, and every financial centre must be regulated.
We promised that at some point we have to show that we've done it. My appeal is, let us send a common signal of strength at the G20.
The third G20 summit since the crisis began will be held in Canada next month. The German Chancellor warned that people in every corner of the globe would be right to ask, whatever came of the other two. Across Europe, leaders have shown an increased resolve to regulate. Earlier in the week, against the advice of Washington, EU governments agreed to tighten rules for hedge funds, and Germany's securities regulator shocked markets by unilaterally announcing a ban on short selling of bank stocks and government debt. Tomorrow, Angela Merkel will address an emergency meeting of European finance ministers in Brussels, where she's expected to come under fire for stating that the euro is in danger. In Paris, the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, defended the shared currency during a joint press conference with the British Prime Minister, David Cameron.
The euro is a success because in a very short span of time, it has become the world's second currency. You can't boil down the euro's success to what has just happened in the last few days. Shall I remind you of the dollar crisis over the last 10 years? Has this prevented the dollar from being the world's number one currency? Let's stand back here. Let's cool down when faced with such events.
David Cameron, who has chosen France as his first foreign destination as Prime Minister, has again ruled out any suggestion that the UK would join the Eurozone. But he lent his voice to calls from France and Germany that stricter rules be imposed on the 16 countries that do use it.
It's in Britain's interests that the Eurozone is a success, that the euro is a successful currency, that the Eurozone economies recover, that the structural imbalances and problems are addressed, that those Eurozone members that have problems are helped. It is in our interest that those things happen. 60% of our trade is with Europe. It's very important that the Eurozone is strong and stable and growing. That's in our own national interest.
There is now consensus among the major European countries that it was naive to have a monetary policy union without some kind of political agreement. Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy, the powerhouses behind the European Union project, will now decide on a set of sanctions for member countries that ignore guidelines about the acceptable size of budget deficits and national debt. There's also talk of unified rules about things as varied as minimum wages, public sector pensions and tax rates. This is Emma Alberici reporting for AM.
The inability of European leaders to contain the widening debt crisis is continuing to spook global share markets. The recovery in the United States also appears to be under threat after jobless claims rose unexpectedly, prompting the biggest one-day fall in more than a year. I'm joined in the studio now by our business editor, Peter Ryan. Well, as we've just heard, European unity appears to be in short supply at the moment. What's that doing to investor confidence in Europe?
Well, Brendan, the lack of coordinated and decisive action from EU leaders on how to stem the debt crisis and defend the euro means investors are dumping anything to do with risk. And we're now seeing almost daily cracks in the political unity of the eurozone, so there have been sharp falls for the second day in a row. Germany's DAX index fell another 2%, adding to yesterday's 2.7% fall after the ban on some speculative trading took other EU members by surprise. But Angela Merkel's focus is dealing with local taxpayer resentment about Germany's role in bailing out Greece rather than the bigger EU picture. France remains bitter about Germany's unilateral action, and so its key index fell another 2.2% this morning.
Peter Ryan, the unfolding European crisis has also taken a toll in US markets, but that wasn't the only reason.
Well, over the past week, good economic news in the US has been overshadowed by the crisis in Europe. But today, the news was all bad. Jobless claims in the US have risen unexpectedly, and some leading indicators of economic growth have also fallen, albeit marginally. There's also continuing concern about a slowdown in China as the government there tightens a hot economy. So as a result, Wall Street had its biggest one-day fall since April 2009. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 3.6% with each of its 30 stocks in the red, and the S&P 500 fell almost 4%. So this adds up to a technical correction on Wall Street, with stocks down some 10% from its most recent high in April.
One of the big casualties has been the Australian dollar, and it's been hit again overnight.
Yes, the Australian dollar is now at a 9-month low of 81.6 US cents. It's also lower against other major currencies as investors shun risk and rush back to the US currency, which has been unpopular for the past year. So far this week, the Australian dollar has lost 6 US cents. That's a far cry from a month ago when it was buying 93 US cents and perhaps heading towards parity with the United States. That doesn't appear to be likely at the moment. The outlook for the Australian dollar isn't good, with commodity prices continuing to fall. A lot of doubt over growth in China and the view that Chinese regulators might step in to cool the economy. And also the European crisis could see interest rates stay on hold for several months. All that makes Australia a whole lot less attractive to global markets. And in another sign about global growth, crude oil has fallen below $65 a barrel for the first time since July last year. It's now slightly recovered.
Business editor Peter Ryan. You're listening to AM Around Australia on Radio National, where it's 20 minutes past seven, and internationally we're on Radio Australia. The New South Wales Premier Christina Keneally has been left to pick up the pieces after one of her senior ministers resigned in shame. The Transport Minister David Campbell was filmed entering a male sex club in Sydney. It's alleged he used a government-funded car to get there. The Premier has had to reshuffle the front bench. Michael Edwards has this report.
In recent times, New South Wales has had its fair share of political scandals, and the latest has brought an end to the ministerial career of one of the state government's senior members, the now former Transport Minister David Campbell. Mr. Campbell resigned last night, shortly before Channel 7 aired footage of him leaving Ken's at Kensington, a gay sex club in Sydney's eastern suburbs. He's accused of using a government car to get to the club, which describes itself as Sydney's most intimate sex venue. Andrew West is a senior reporter at the Sydney Morning Herald and a long-time observer of New South Wales politics.
The events that have been uncovered appear to be, you know, matters in his personal and private life, so I'm not really sure that there was a compelling case for him to resign.
In a statement, David Campbell apologised to his wife and family. The Premier, Christina Keneally, has urged the community to show understanding. Mr Campbell's last few months as New South Wales Transport Minister were tough. He weathered heavy criticism for his handling of a massive traffic jam on the F3 freeway, which connects Sydney and Newcastle. And his departure comes soon after Labor backbencher Karen Palazzano resigned from Parliament after she admitted lying to the Independent Commission Against Corruption about falsifying employee pay forms. Andrew West says while he doesn't believe David Campbell has done anything wrong, he says it is more evidence that the New South Wales government is struggling.
What it does emphasise, though, is the ill-disciplined nature of the New South Wales government, and that does make it very difficult, less than a year out from an election, to have another minister resign so soon after a backbencher is forced to resign after, you know, a problem in ICAC. It adds to a gathering climate. There is something fundamentally rotten in the state of New South Wales.
The New South Wales opposition leader, Barry O'Farrell, has declined to comment so far, but many others are weighing into the issue. The gay and lesbian community says it's disappointing that so much attention has been paid to David Campbell attending a gay men's club. Kelly MacDonald is from the Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby.
I think it's indicative of a homophobic culture to focus on the fact that he was at a gay venue rather than focus on the fact that he was allegedly misusing government resources.
And Cameron Murphy from the New South Wales Council for Civil Liberties says he's worried that what should be a private matter for David Campbell has entered the public arena.
This is essentially a private matter. It's a matter for him and for his family. It's got nothing to do with anybody else. No one's sexuality is a matter of public interest. It's essentially a private matter.
Cameron Murphy from the New South Wales Council for Civil Liberties, ending Michael Edwards's report. It's a recent requirement that travellers to Australia have to declare any pornography they're carrying, but it's now been condemned by lobbyists for internet freedom and the sex industry. They say it won't stop the importation of child porn and other banned material. The groups argue it will instead lead to ordinary people being subjected to humiliating searches. Samantha Donovan reports.
The Australian Customs Service says that since late last year, people arriving in Australia have had to declare whether or not they're carrying pornography, just as they have to do with other restricted items like medicine or weapons. It says the aim is to prevent the importation of pornography that includes children, extreme violence, or other material that violates Australian law. But the Australian Sex Party says it's a badly thought-out invasion of privacy that won't crack down on prohibited material. The party's president, Fiona Patten, says all adults entering Australia will be affected.
I understand we're the only country that asks whether you are carrying any pornography on entering the country.
In a statement to AM, the Australian Customs Service said including an express reference to pornography is intended to enhance the interception of prohibited material at the border. If travellers declare pornography and it isn't illegal, they'll keep it. Illegal pornography will be confiscated and fines or charges may be laid. But the Australian Sex Party's Fiona Patten says that may put some people in embarrassing situations at airports.
If you have something that you think is slightly explicit, and it might be, you know, some photos you've taken with your partner, or, you know, or a funny email that you've received from your work colleagues, if you don't answer the question, you are caught with this material, then you are in big trouble. So you will respond to this question with a yes if you're an honest person. I certainly don't think that seeing a criminal illegally importing child pornography is actually going to declare on their incoming passenger card that they are carrying it.
Electronic Frontiers Australia is a non-profit organisation that lobbies for online freedom and rights. It's also worried there'll be a surge in unwarranted searches of people's laptops, phones and cameras, and it's calling for the new customs powers to be revoked. Chairman Colin Jacobs says more attention needs to be paid to people's privacy.
These changes seem to have been snuck in under the radar. They have enormous privacy implications for anybody who's visiting Australia, and it's very unclear just what they're supposed to achieve. People could have all sorts of pictures and videos on their hard drive, and especially for visitors to this country, it'd be very difficult to describe or for them to know just what might fall afoul of our classification scheme. There's a lot of material that would actually be legal to own and view in this country. You can't sell it or you can't import it, even though it would be considered by most Australians to be relatively harmless. People just have a presumption to a right of privacy rather than everybody being treated like a smuggler when they get to Australia's shores.
Colin Jacobs, the chairman of Electronic Frontiers Australia, ending Samantha Donovan's report. The mayor of Paris calls it an intolerable attack on the city's heritage. A lone thief has broken into the Museum of Modern Art in Paris, stealing five masterpieces, including a Picasso. Art experts say the paintings will either be held for ransom or used as collateral by crime gangs. Rachel Brown reports from London.
Cast aside any romantic notions of art heists being elaborately planned affairs. This crude heist was executed with seemingly surprise ease. The thief sheared off a gate padlock and broke a window to get into the Musée d'Art Moderne, then disabled the alarm system. Paris's deputy mayor, Christophe Girard.
Il y a ce que l'on appelle des rondes.
There are sensors and heavy security, and there are three people permanently stationed in the museum who were there. It's quite clear that the system was disabled somehow, because the three people present didn't see a thing.
The loot is a roll call of the greatest names in 20th century art. Picasso's Cubist Dove with Green Peas, Matisse's Pastoral, Braque's Olive Tree Near a Stark, Modigliani's Woman with a Fan, and Léger's Still Life with Candlestick. This heist is the biggest since four paintings by Cézanne, Degas, Van Gogh and Monet were stolen from a Zurich museum in 2008. Former Scotland Yard detective Dick Ellis, who led the recovery of Edvard Munch's Scream, says the paintings will be impossible to offer on the open market.
I would suspect that we will either see a ransom going in over the next few months and they will attempt to sell these paintings back to the museum. That usually fails. Or they will have some ulterior motive where these will be used as an international currency, if you like.
Recovery's manager with London's Art Loss Register, Antonia Kimball, doubts a Mr. Big of the art world has commissioned the theft.
I don't believe that there is someone sitting in a castle sort of rubbing their hands together hoping for this Batiste to be hung above their fireplace.
She says art is the new criminal collateral.
With the terrorism laws that are very strict in many of the countries around the world, money moving between accounts is being watched by the banks, so transferring of funds is much more scrutinised. So to put down a Picasso that's worth, I don't know, £50 to £100 million as a down payment for another deal, such as an arms deal or a drugs deal, it's used as collateral, and then when the money is recovered, they would then take the Picasso back and use it in another deal later on.
Art experts say if the works aren't found within 3 months, it could take decades. Of the 13 masterpieces stolen in the world's biggest art theft in 1990 in Boston, in which the thieves dressed up as police officers, a Vermeer, Rembrandt and Manet remain missing. This is Rachel Brown in London reporting for AM.
On the financial markets in New York, the Dow Jones Index has closed at 10,068 points, down 376 points. The Nasdaq has closed at 2,204, down 94 points. The dollar is buying 81.55 US cents. It's buying 73.04 Japanese yen. I'm Brendan Trembath, and that's AM for today.